From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, another way of looking at Edward Abbey. Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire, is 50 years old now. It's his love letter to Red Rock Country, and it's inspired a lot of people, including the writer Amy Irvine. In her book, she offers a tribute, but also a rebuke. She challenges Abbey's passion for the land, his ideas about solitude, and his misogyny. She'll join us after this.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Edward Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire, is 50 years old now. In it, he invited people to go to the desert by explaining what it meant for him to experience such space and beauty all by himself. The thing is, Abbey wasn't really alone for a lot of that time in the desert. He was there with his wife and with his kids sometimes. But he left them out of the manuscript, actually edited them out. And this is one of the things the writer Amy Irvine wanted to understand. In her book, she imagines going to crusty, curmudgeonly Edward Abbey's secret grave in the desert to confront him and challenge him. The book is driven by questions and concerns that she says threatened to rush from her body like a river freed from a blown-up dam. Her book is called Desert Cabal, A New Season in the Wilderness, and she's joining us today to talk about it. Amy's a writer, a public lands activist. She teaches in the MFA program at Southern New Hampshire University. Her first book, Trespass, Living at the Edge of the Promised Land, came out in 2008. She's joining us here in the studio, and welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's really good to be back, Doug. Thank you.
When did you first read Desert Solitaire? Do you remember?
I did. I had a high school teacher who saw me slipping drastically after I lost my first boyfriend, and he actually knew that I already had ties to the land, having grown up here, and he gave me a copy of Desert Solitaire and the Monkey Wrench Gang and said, read these, go to the Escalante, and don't come back until you have some sort of epiphany, otherwise I will fail you.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that. And can you say you had some kind of epiphany?
I did have an epiphany, and that was the language of Desert Solitaire actually didn't completely wow me because it was already a language I knew in my own experience.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, too.
Monkey Wrench Gang was more, it wasn't the actual eco-terrorism of that. I understood that that was probably a trope. It was an exciting fantasy, but what it did was give me a deeper sense of being able to speak and act on behalf of my homeland, really.
One of the things you said was that before Abbey, in some ways, you had taken this place for granted.
Yeah. Utah has this amazing acreage that belong to all the American people. And I hadn't really understood the privileges and responsibilities that came with that. They were just sort of the place we went to go camping or fishing or hunting or skiing.
At what point did you start to, I mean, you confess in the book, as you just mentioned, that it wasn't really life-changing in the sense that you knew the place for yourself. You guys would go camping and stuff like that. But at what point did you start to rethink Edward Abbey and some of his attitudes? I'm guessing that for more than a few women have been turned off by the kind of, you know, sexist language that he uses. But at what point did you really start to think, and because you deeply challenge a lot of his ideas.
Right.
And when did that start, can you say?
You know, I sometimes think I was born into a mindset because I don't share it with much of my family, my Mormon heritage. But early as a kid, I remember feeling a little excluded from a kind of male privilege in the culture at large in Utah. And So when I read Abby, I had that little voice in the back of my head saying, "What this feels, I feel excluded in some sort of way. I feel like I don't have a right." And I would say that I really began to take issue with it after I graduated from the University of Utah with a degree in women's studies. And then from there, it rolled. But re-encountering the narrative after Trump was elected and Me Too happened and pussy grabs and land grabs were happening alike, all of a sudden, I felt incredibly alienated. And the number of millennials that I've taught lately, and I do teach a lot of them, the men and women alike really have an issue with the exclusivity of his language and the fact that he calls it Abby's country, which I say in the book. Can you imagine in my own book about Utah's deserts if I had called it Amy's country? That nobody would have gone for that.
Yeah. For a while, did you ever feel like, I'm not sure I can express this openly, that in some ways it's seen as heresy
Absolutely.
To go after Abby?
Absolutely. I was terrified at speaking to him. And I should clarify here that I never actually went to his grave. It's a literary device, which I've also gotten blowback for using. There's a disclaimer in the beginning about that I never actually go there and I don't have any interest in finding his grave. It's more the ideas that he left behind and the way they frame our view of wilderness that I was interested in.
I did want to ask you about that just before you move on, because it is something that I mentioned in the introduction that you went there. And I was sort of thinking it was a literary conceit, too. But I did wonder if you actually go and actually did pace up and down. And maybe if not at the actual grave, if at some campsite that you imagined yourself having a conversation with Edward Abbey, if you know what I mean.
As I began to circle around what I wanted to say, and as terrified and intimidated as I was, I realized that right now is a time where we're really needing to hear a multitude of voices speaking about their experience, and that I really couldn't do this without speaking to Abby directly as my own person and him as his own person. It felt like a much more important way to have the conversation.
Yeah. Terry Tempest Williams once told you that there's a difference between what is private and what is personal.
Right.
And she said you should probably keep the private part to yourself. Keep that off the page. Mm-hmm. But this is really personal and private, it seems. And I'm wondering if you have a difficult time keeping both of those things separate and keeping the private. I mean, because it's very confessional and it does seem quite private.
Right. And there's blowback about that as well. I think that it's, for me, it was so much about challenging the construct of solitude and the way it's been put forward. For a lot of us, solitude is actually dangerous or traumatic, and sometimes it's a type of avoidance. And so that was sort of the place I began, and knowing that solitude for sometimes for me was a very dark place. But even more to the point, I was teaching at an environmental writing workshop this summer at a beautiful retreat center where there were other groups also there, one of which was women veterans of the armed forces who had PTSD. One day I'm walking along a beautiful path in these woods to get to my workshop, and I came across an African-American woman who was having a very, maybe even a flashback, a very, very traumatized reaction. She was paralyzed, hyperventilating. So I said, "Are you okay?" And she grabbed my arm and said, "You've got to get me out of here." I said, "Okay, let's walk up the path. Tell me where you need to go. I don't know. You just have to get me out of here." So we're walking along. I'm just asking her questions about where to go. A twig snaps in the bushes and she jumps. And I said, "It's okay. It was probably a bird or a squirrel. You're safe here." And she looked at me and she said, "Honey, don't you ever tell a black woman that she's safe in the wilderness." And that made me realize not only how I still have a place of position as a privileged white woman that going into the wilderness, and that even I couldn't speak some complete counter narrative, that our relationship to solitude is profoundly contextual. Mm-hmm. And I think more than ever, we have to sort of reckon with that, especially with the numbers of us that are flocking into the wilderness to try and have that, whatever our definition of solitude is.
Yeah. You in this conversation, quote unquote, you're having with Edward Abbey, you say, look, you need to settle in because this is not going to be easy. And I'm not going to be chummy, and I'm not going to call you Ed. I'm going to call you Mr. Abbey. What is that edge there? Explain that to me. Are you angry with him? Are you angry with an idea? And I'm not even sure angry is the right way of putting it, but it is confrontational.
Yeah, I don't feel angry at Abbey at all. I feel the way I feel about privileged patriarchy, the way he felt about industry and tourism and big government. And he was in a great position to attack those things. Yeah. And he did so beautifully. And I'm so grateful for him helping me see these landscapes through that lens. But he wasn't in a position to talk about how his definition of solitude and his attitude towards women and people with other colors of skin, immigration, people trying to get into a better life. He was not in a position to speak about those things in a meaningful way at the time, or maybe he was, but he chose not to.
Yeah.
And whether it's a literary device or not, to be sort of curmudgeonly and misanthropic, we now know the danger of exclusive words. And he was certainly writing at a time when we had civil rights and women's rights happening. And what I hear frequently about this was, well, he was just writing from another generation. He was actually writing in the midst of when people were realizing that you'd really didn't get to treat women as other or other people of color as other. And I think to defend him so staunchly not only attempts to put me in some other sort of silenced little corner, it also it sounds a little bit like the boys will be boys that we're hearing about.
Yeah. I wonder if it at all – it just seems so – it must – have seemed disappointing to hear a man who had so many just brilliant insights about the environment and place to say such kind of tone-deaf things about immigrants and women.
Right.
And I wonder, did it make you rethink some of his – and we'll kind of get to this a bit but did it make you rethink some of his insights about deserts and beauty?
Absolutely. There's a few chapters in here that talk about women who have been assaulted on public lands. And there's a chapter in particular about a female tourist who was stabbed 29 times in Havasu Canyon. And my experience was actually a bit threatening in Havasu Canyon, yeah. Very different from Abby's experience there. And so it has had me completely – I mean, I really struggled to find the right language and even the questions I wanted to ask him. I'd like to think that he would have evolved with the rest of us to a point of saying, actually, I would not support Trump's wall. But he may have. And what do we do with that when we have people like Edward Abbey and Dave Foreman of Earth First opposing immigration? I don't think we can talk about – public lands and the environment and natural quote-unquote resources any longer without talking about the social injustices that intersect with those things, the poverty among indigenous people, race relations, we have sort of had a blind spot to the ways that male violence unfolds on public lands. I have to say all but one male that I felt threatened by, I was in a dangerous situation with on public lands. Only one was not white. So in the book, I tell him, I say, we have this mass epidemic of mass shootings and serial killers, and the vast majority of them are white males. What clearly there are implications to you assuming a position of privilege. What do we do about that?
It's interesting, and we'll work through this a bit too, but on one hand you seem, and I hope this isn't the wrong word, but kind of pessimistic about the state of things right now, about diminished solitude in the desert, as you referred to a second ago, about public lands being threatened, obviously. about how trashed you think Moab has become and climate change. And so there's that on one hand in this book. But then on the other hand, there's this really deeply hopeful kind of sentiment, and we'll come back around to it, but it is there. And so it's interesting the contrasts that you offer in the book.
Right. Well, I'm always looking for the counter narrative. I'm always looking for the other piece that's not there when we look at things so black and white. And never have we been so dualistic in our politics, in our ideas about public lands, in our ideas about race relations and gender relations. And yet there's this incredible nuance happening, right? Like we see transgender issues coming to light in a way they never have. We see women at the core of these important movements, such as Black Lives Matter and what happened at Standing Rock and with our own Bears Ears. The way the Five Tribes came together to speak on behalf of the Bears Ears and help get that proclaimed by President Obama, and sadly that's been stripped away, as has their agreement to be co-managers with the Department of Interior. But the genie's out of the bottle. Like, we have all these amazing voices now. We have these new constituencies. And truly, if we want to protect what's left, and it's no longer for a white privileged construct of just the aesthetic of public lands and the desert and the recreational privileges, like, we don't have time to quibble about those finer details. We have a planet to save. And I unfortunately have had some blowback from some of my mentors and colleagues in the nature writing world and the public lands advocacy world. And I am, you know, with you don't get to talk to Abby that way, and you didn't even know him. Abby himself talked to Annie Dillard in his own writing and criticized her writing quite harshly, even as she admired him. And so
it was the same. He wrote the same kind of essay as you have.
Exactly.
Challenging her.
But nobody got after him for that. I've had some pretty serious blowback, and I think that it's actually a bit petulant and self-absorbed to take issue with whether or not I get to write, just talk to Edward Abbey in my, you know, in my own way, because truly, again, we're looking at saving these big landscapes because we're looking at planetary survival. It's no longer about who gets to, you know, ride a mountain bike versus a dirt bike or a rock crawler. I mean, we all, the dualities of those two constituencies are actually not true, because we actually have more of us that love public lands for various reasons. There are many people that want to make a living off of them for various reasons. We have a chance here to rally around that common love in a way that we haven't before.
I wonder if how you translate that concern for these dualities into action or something. Because clearly you're going to have to get people together on both sides of these issues, on various sides. And I'm wondering how you are thinking about making that happen. I mean, you do talk about the quote-unquote other side of the public lands mm-hmm. debate and the connection that you felt to ranchers, for example. Mm-hmm. And even there's a story where you say that there's a part of you that really kind of appreciated what the Bundys did when they took over that wildlife refuge in Oregon, just in the sense of that kind of active resistance
right
there. So how are you envisioning that happening? Are these relationships, are these friendships, conversations?
Right. Well, in the book, I use complicity in a way that was very scary, because it was very vulnerable and very revealing. But I didn't feel like I could to have a tete-a-tete with Abby without actually saying, these are the places in which I've also made mistakes, or my high carbon footprint is off the charts. And he had five wives, I had three husbands. So there was a way, you know, when you're in marriage therapy or family counseling, the first rule you learn is own your own stuff before you point the finger somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I felt like that kind of complicity has not happened on the quote-unquote liberal side that typically is aligned with public lands protection and wilderness designation and national monuments being proclaimed. We have to be a little bit more honest about our carbon footprints and our consumption levels and then also just step over the fence and say, hey, can I'm on this paleo diet and I eat your beef. Can I help you move your cows today? Or, you know, I just think we've gotten so solidified in these two sides. And many of my closest friends and family are ranchers. They're certainly not my enemy, and they're certainly not entirely the enemy of the land. And as long as we're buying their beef, we don't really get to point the finger at them.
Amy Irvine is with us. Her book is Desert Cabal, A New Season in the Wilderness. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the Support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, another way of looking at Edward Abbey. Abbey's book, Desert Solitaire, his love letter to Red Rock Country, has inspired generations of people, including the writer Amy Irvine. In her latest book, she offers a kind of tribute, but it's also, in some ways, a challenge. She challenges his passion for the land, his ideas about solitude, about immigration, women. Her book is called Desert Cabal, A New Season in the Wilderness. I wanted to ask you about, you write about the kind of the seductive qualities of the desert and how you yourself gave into that seduction. And the metaphor you use is that it's like pulling off a sketchy move on an exposed cliff band. There comes that move, you say, that cannot be reversed. And you mentioned this, Abby having five wives, you having three husbands. But it's interesting you say you really want to know if you're coming at this from opposite directions or if, in fact, you were headed the same way on this trail. Talk about that part. I thought this was interesting and kind of revealing and kind of confessional here about mm-hmm. intimacy and the seduction of that place and the idea of, sex, frankly.
Right. Yeah, I think, this is not a new idea that women's that the body and a body of land or Mother Earth have often been aligned with female bodies for, all the sort of predictable metaphors. But I think there's also a kind of consumptive value. I mean, Abby wrote about in Desert Solitaire about wanting to just greedily possess this landscape. And I think we have to get away from that kind of consumptive approach. I think that it's dehumanizing and objectifying in a way that strangely sort of the land cannot be that. But I also, again, had to make myself complicit because he and I clearly were looking for something that, the sensual qualities, intimacy, vulnerability, and I think a lot of people project that actually onto the desert, that sort of nakedness yeah. that we don't dare own in ourselves. And of course, if you don't own that in yourself, how are you ever going to have a successful relationship with either the land or another human being?
We were referring to this earlier, but you mentioned to in this in this conversation with Abby that there are new rules of engagement between men and women. Talk about the Me Too movement, and his treatment of women is disappointing for you. He hit on your mother at a book signing.
Yes. It was 2 months before his death, which, of course, we didn't know. But my mom had gone down to stand in line at Sam Weller's, I think. And he was signing Fool's Progress for me, and he hit on her. And
now, mind you, she was not a desert wanderer. She hadn't really read anything. She didn't know Edward Abbey, really.
Right.
She was doing this for you.
It was a lovely gesture on my mom's part.
Yeah.
It was so thoughtful. And, of course, it became even more thoughtful when he died a few months later. But I said, well, how did you feel when he hit on you? And she said, well, I was kind of flattered. And I said, Mom, you know, that's sort of where we've come from. You know, her generation would have been flattered. And certainly even two decades ago, I would have been flattered. But we've entered a whole new era.
Yeah. There's this thing he writes. He writes, if we could learn to love space as deeply as we are now obsessed with time,
oh, indeed,
we might discover a new meaning in the phrase, to live like men.
Right.
And in the book, you ask, what did he mean to live like men? What was it you're trying to find out there? What did you notice in that?
Well, I just, as I have felt with the Mormon Church and another sort of patriarchal institutions or constructs that I've entered into, I just feel such a sense of exclusion. And, you know, it wasn't unlike when my father and my uncles and male cousins would all go hunting. And I'd be like, well, can I go? Well, no, you can't. So I feel like I've sort of wrangled with this all my life. And but I didn't – the first few times I read those books, I was not – I didn't feel marginalized. I did somewhere. There was a little bit of it, but it wasn't until more recently that I realized the power of those words to keep me in a category of other.
So they were just kind of they were there, but you hadn't realized them, hadn't made them conscious,
right? And I think this is very typical of social movements. Like the degrees are, you know, we move towards new realities in very tiny degrees.
Yeah.
But we are changing. I mean, my daughter now, her ability to think in nuance, she just, for her, for example, sexuality, gender is this just incredible spectrum. And she can hold all that. And I think we've assumed that our children think in dualities the way we do. And I'm not so certain. They're willing to share the planet with a lot of different types of people and a lot of different species. And they understand in a way we don't, because they're so globally connected, what's at stake now. It's no longer, well, do I get to ride my ATV on that little patch of desert, or are the tree huggers going to claim it and put a fence around it? It's more like we need huge landscapes now to hold the planet together. And the kids understand that.
There's this idea of Abby's idea of being an individual. You confront him about that too.
Right. Here's
what he wrote. He wrote, "The living organism stands out bold and brave and vivid against the lifeless sand and barren rock." But you mention how Abby couldn't really, you say he couldn't really handle the wide open space between organisms or the sparseness of desert society.
Yeah, in that he had a wife and children in Albuquerque, and he had many women that visited him in his trailer. He makes no bones about that. And I felt that was important to speak to, because I think it's a part of the way we other the desert, the way we other women and other bodies. And it's a literary trope that we can take issue with, in the way that you can take issue with me pretending that I'm actually talking to him squatted on his grave. But we have to look at the bigger pictures and what are the results of those things. I can see why he used solitude as the device by which to speak about his season in the wilderness. It's so much less messy, so much less complicated.
Yeah. And you relate to this.
I completely relate to it. And I think that's probably what Terry meant when she said there's a difference between writing what's personal and what's private. And I get pretty personal and somewhat private, but it's a gesture towards something deeper that actually connects us to one another in a way that we need to be connected before we can actually connect to a place we want to save.
The immigration stuff he wrote about, and I was reading some this morning, the conservatives love their cheap labor, the liberals love their cheap cause, he said. And he wrote this, it might be wise for us as American citizens to consider calling a halt to the mass influx of even more millions of hungry, ignorant, unskilled, and culturally, morally, genetically impoverished people.
Right.
At least until we've brought our own affairs into order. And then there's that reference that you put in your book, that if every campesino at the southern border, if you just give him a handgun and a good rifle and a case of ammunition and send them home. What do you make of that? Just a kind of clueless white privilege? Was there actual racism there? What do you make of it?
You know, I think...
This sounds pretty brutal.
Yeah, it sounds really brutal. And it's really alarming. And I don't think that the wilderness movement can ignore this any longer. We have issues, you know, population issues and resource consumption are dire. And we have to reckon with those anytime we talk about public lands or protecting open space. And how can we hold the whole of them? To be exclusive, I think, creates and to say, you know, keep all these people out, we need to take care of ourselves. I understand the desire to do that, but in doing so, we impoverish ourselves as human. So and once we do that, are we really saving landscapes at all?
Have you heard any pushback about this one? The idea of immigration and you going after Abby about that? That, Amy, you don't get it. He was being tongue-in-cheek. He wasn't really that way. I mean, are you getting that kind of reaction?
Yes, yes. And again, I think it's sort of protecting a privileged position. I had a gentleman from Utah send a letter to Torrey House Press, who's been just a marvelous, fearless publisher, along with Back of Beyond Books. This is Back of Beyond's first effort in publishing something. We have had some pushback about who gets to speak out about Abby, and, you know, you shouldn't bring those kinds of things into the conversation. And I'm like, well, actually, we have to. It's long overdue. Otherwise, we sound dangerously like we're speaking, you know, back to a place where some environmentalists were hinting at the usefulness of eugenics and that kind of thing. So, scary stuff.
Yeah. There's a moment I wanted to ask you about, a section in the book where you write about, in Desert Solitaire, Abby writes about his moon-eyed horse, this horse that had escaped a ranch. And he has this kind of crazy, delirious conversation with the horse. And there's an experience you have with a horse, Dante.
Yeah.
And you came to know the desert in a new way with this horse, and so you really had a connection here. Talk a little bit about this, because this is a Abby trying to befriend this horse, and I thought this was a really interesting moment.
Well, yeah, I think the one of the places we had connective tissue where I really felt like I could meet with Abby was over our love of these two horses that had been wounded, badly treated, and it just withdrawn from the world. And it certainly, there seemed to be some sort of example there of what happens to us, and the suggestion that maybe our seeking out of solitude as opposed to, say, solidarity or demanding privacy when really what we need is intimacy. These horses held a lot of that for both of us. And while he never got to ride the moon-eyed horse, much as he wanted to, which, of course, riding it would have meant they had arrived at some sort of trust relationship with one another.
Yeah.
In my case, I had the good privilege of having that experience with Dante. And it was terrifying to give so much to an animal that needed that much given to him before he could trust me. And it was so hard earned, as I think a marriage that's really highly functioning is hard earned. And I again, just trying to bring that kind of connectivity to land, I don't think either side. I think the left side often gets caught up in recreational use in a way that feels, again, consumptive or objectifying. And until we sort of reckon with that and the way that we need to reckon with immigration, that I don't think we're going to win this thing.
What was a lesson you took from you had to give Dante back?
Oh,
which was tough. But then you also tell the story where you let him go, and then you go and it's a great story where you see him again, and right. he's out there, and he's different, and he's kind of healed in some ways, yeah. And really pleased to see you.
Really pleased to see me. He wouldn't let anybody near me,
yeah.
Including his own, the lead mare, who was his girlfriend. And it just brought me to my knees to have that kind of intense bond with such a big, powerful animal who had really had his spirit broken, and to see him come back. And in a way, that old adage, you know, if you love something, set it free. And that's sort of like setting things free. Like, can we really set all these people free from the categories we've put ourselves in? Can we really set the land free without having to use it? I had a bit of a falling out with an educator in my daughter's school who said after hearing about what had happened to the Bears Ears with Trump eviscerating it so severely and also denying the tribes any co-management privileges, which is how he perceived them, she was furious and saying all kinds of awful things about the other side. And I said, well, you bought a second house in Bluff so you could be near there and recreate there every weekend, and that is part of the problem also. And she blusteringly quickly said, if I'd rather us hike it to death than have them drill and mine and graze it to death. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we somehow feel that we have rights that we actually don't, because if only by sheer numbers, we are doing a significant amount of damage as well. So can you protect wilderness for its own sake?
What do you think?
I'm hopeful. The millennials that I've been seeing lately have such an understanding of these landscapes as something that need to be set free, and knowing that they're there, and maybe you go a couple of times a year rather than every single weekend. Like, what in your life isn't sustainable here in the city or in a rural impoverished area? Like, what could you make happen in your life so that you're not needing to go out and escape and find this thing all the time? That's not to say that we don't go out,
yeah,
and love it and have an experience and come back, but how can we do it in a less impactful manner?
What do you think they understand, that younger generation that we seem to have missed? Like, why is it they've figured this out, or seem to be, some of them anyway, figuring this out?
I think in large part they've grown up with social media, so they're very connected to one another, and they have access to a lot of information in a way we don't. They are growing up hearing voices.
Listen to you put a positive spin on social media.
You know, the fourth and final husband, the man that I love as I have loved no other, after many, many hard lessons, because I feel a little bit like Dante, like I had to right. heal significantly. He and I developed a relationship and built a lot of trust, created a profound friendship over social media before we ever met. And just as kids, I was just hearing from a number of my Mormon friends that their nieces and nephews are actually meeting on Tinder and having lasting relationships, getting married in the temple and starting families after having found one another in this way that I thought only had to do with sorted one-night stands. So I think we don't understand the power of that kind of community that gets created, or intimacy that gets created with people that would otherwise be unknown to us.
So that's the thing that we've missed, is connection,
right.
Intimacy,
right.
Constant conversation, checking in with people.
Exactly.
Which is interesting, because we sort of see that as bad. Like, why do you have to always be on your damn phone? What you're seeing is, well, look, they're connecting with someone. They're...
Right. Right.
That's a new spin.
Yeah. They're seeing the last polar bear standing on the coffee table-sized iceberg. They are seeing the trophy hunting happening in Africa. They are seeing the profound effects of climate change in terms of these disastrous storms. And they're relating to it in a way. For us, there's like some degree of separation because and I wonder if it's because it doesn't feel quite real to us. We don't understand those images in the same way the kids do.
10 years since your last book.
Yes.
A lot happened in between.
I had a daughter with pretty serious health issues that weren't accurately diagnosed for a long time. And as a mother, that really takes you out of any sort of work, especially because my daughter's her seizures, sometimes 20 or 30 a night, meant no sleep, and the last thing you could do is write a coherent sentence the following day. So there were a lot of years where I did not have the luxury, even though I had exactly the same writing space as Mr. Abbey up at Pat Creek. He, yeah. Seldom Seen Smith, the Slights generously gave him a cabin to write in up there. And I had dear friends who gave me a place to write up there. And as I say, at one point, you kept a journal, I kept vigil, because he started to write and I had to put down the pen and walk away. So
why?
It's
because of circumstance, or was
circumstances?
It
was, yeah. I think it's, you know, when
is this the difference also between being a woman,
exactly,
a mother caring for a child, and a man who can?
Yeah, some of which is understandable.
Sure, of course.
You know, I had less earning power than Ruby's father. I was the one that was breastfeeding. There were many reasons that it made sense for me to be the one at home. But there's also a cultural expectation that women will sacrifice what they're doing in order to take care of the family. And Mr. Abbey didn't have to do that. In fact, he got to have his luxurious time in Arches, which is something that certainly wouldn't have happened had I tried to have that job with a child.
There's a chapter where you, as you put it, complicate the narrative, where you confess to being on this particular trip just overbearing with your sister.
Right.
it's the story when you were in high school, and you write this, I'm beginning to get why you, Mr. Abbey, why you wrote about solitude and why the characters in your books were casual acquaintances, not intimates.
Right.
What do you mean?
It's so much cleaner to write that way. It's so much easier, but it's not true. You know, the original manuscript, there's... which I had the good fortune of looking at, thanks to Clark Abbey, Ed's widow and beloved, and the University of Arizona, who offered up the original manuscript. When I got to look at it, there is the very overt mention of the wife and children, and there's a red line through it. So it was a very conscious choice. His literary device was to pretend he was solitary, and mine was to pretend I was at his grave. But I'm getting a lot more flack for that than he did.
Which is interesting.
And I think there's a long tradition of sort of being curmudgeonly and misanthropic. Thoreau certainly had the same tendency. And if you really look closely at some of his writings that are lesser well known, he's very misanthropic. And a famous Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, Catherine Schultz, wrote a piece about him in The New Yorker 3 years ago called Pond Scum. And she said to me in a conversation, she got so much more hateful hate mail about having sort of knocked Thoreau into his own waters. And he had the luxury too of being solitary because the woman down the road did all of his cooking and cleaning and laundry.
Yeah, and he would go pick up his laundry. It only took him like 20 minutes
exactly.
to get his laundry.
Yeah. So I feel like we're not only maintaining
knocking these people off their pedestals, that's rough work, I guess.
It's rough work. And a lot of even our own kind, which I think this is a problem. Rebecca Solnit talks about how the left keeps eating its young. And I feel like this is a place where Catherine Schultz and I both got beat up for writing about these icons. And really, no matter what Trump says or does, he has this support base that rallies around him regardless. And I feel like we don't have that kind of solidarity and that now is the time for it.
Do you think – so Chuck Bowden, whom you knew, and mm-hmm. he was on this program a number of times, amazing writer.
Amazing writer.
So here's his observation about Abbey and Red Caddy. He says, I think everyone would save themselves a lot of time and trouble if they just concluded he was guilty of every vice and ism known to man. And he wrote this, he will never be what you approve of, though he will, with alarming frequency, be what you secretly think but are afraid to say or admit to.
Right.
Do you think that's true?
I do think that's true. A little bit the way I did in this book. Again, very similar effort in writing, in that we made it, we both said a lot of things that you weren't supposed to say on the page. We sort of toppled a lot of romantic constructs on the page, and he then rebuilt them. I don't know that my book or my voice will ever have that opportunity, nor do I want it to. I think now is a time for a multitude of voices, and I sort of think of the wilderness community and the nature writing canon as sort of being housed in an ivory cabin, not unlike academia being housed in an ivory tower, and that there are all these other voices out there howling in the wilderness, and what happens if we open that door and step out and join them in the woods?
I want to have you read a section from the book, if you would, because this is the part where you tell Abby that as timeless as his book is, things are changing in ways, you put it, even his nimble mind could not have imagined. And we went through this litany of public land and climate change and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But you see in your – this is where the book really turns. You get a sense that – boy, this is despairing. And then you turn to hope. And you see in your daughter, Ruby, the face, you say, of a hopeful, sustainable future. And we were talking about young people just a moment ago. But there's this moment, there's this something that he says, that he writes, Abby, love flowers best in openness and freedom.
Right.
And you want to change that a bit.
Yeah. And I mean, that sentence rang so true with me in my 20s that in my first marriage, that was what I put on the wedding invitation. And at some point, I joke in there that I was thinking botanically, and my first husband clearly thought it meant also an open marriage so he could, you know, flower with whomever he chose. And so, at this point, I say, this leads me to the thing I've most wanted to say today. Would you mind me revising that phrase from the book, the one I lifted for my first wedding invitation? What if it read, love flowers best in close quarters? It's not a question, actually. It's a must. We are on our way to being crammed together like cows in a feedlot. To survive without turning into heartless monsters or soul-sucked automatons, we'll need intimacy with people every bit as much as with place. The wound, the anger and apathy that masks it, is what drives us to be le solitaire, which in French refers to one who is isolated, a kind of lone wolf. And as we know, lone wolves never survive. Like, it's dangerous. You get eaten or killed. But the French form also means tapeworm. Going it alone is a failure of contribution and compassion, and this is what drains the world dry. Ultimately, this is why I'm here today, to invite you to join me in asking your followers to do away with their rugged individualism, which I never bought anyway. By nature, we are a cabal, a group gathered around a panoramic vision, a group gathered to conspire, to resist. This is vital to our survival as institutions fail and tyranny threatens. Believe me when I say that our democracy, with its wide but firm embrace of the last best wild places, has never been so jeopardized. I actually prefer the French term cabal. The E makes it a female noun, and that rings true about now. While cabal means political conspiracy and intrigue, it is imbued with spiritual and mystical meanings too. And I'd say the divine thing we've been given is nature itself, both ours and the land's. Our most precious resource now is wonder. What we wonder about ignites our imagination, unleashes our empathy, fuels our ferocity. We fold in on ourselves, a thunderous, galloping gathering, a passionate, peopled storm, nearly indistinguishable from the ground on which it rains, on which it sprinkles seeds. This is how hope takes root. What springs forth are monolithic possibilities.
It seems like what you're saying is, yes, go out into the desert, of course, go out into the desert. He invited you to, I'm inviting you to, but it seems like the insight you have in the book is, but then come back and join us.
Right. Right. I think we have become so isolated in many ways. And I think there's a way we're starting to try and escape our own realities and our own communities and our own families by getting out there. And the sort of extreme excess of athleticism we're seeing now in public lands There's a line in that that says the land's not the thing, it's the buzz.
Yeah. And you want them to not be tourists and thrill seekers. You want them to get something from it and bring it back and contribute,
right.
I guess.
Right, because I think we can no longer vote or protest against that which we disagree with. Like, there's a way that's become so polarizing that it's just paralyzing. And it's fueled by hate. So I posed a question to a group of students yesterday at Utah Valley University. I said, you know, how many of you feel like your vote matters anymore? And a few handfuls went up. But I said, what if you vote out of love? What if you speak on behalf of and write public comment letters and go canvass for political nominees? What if you did that all out of love? What if you voted for what's in your heart rather than what you're against? And they seem to really respond to that. And I know I do. It's the only way that this movement is sustainable.
Amy Irvine, her book is Desert Cabal, A New Season in the Wilderness. Amy, thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directed the show today. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.